بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of God, most gracious, most merciful. Today, hopefully, I'll give you a small talk introducing the religion of Islam. And to save time, of course, I have to sit down on what topics we'll discuss. But if there's any questions afterwards, we'll start out of time to discuss any issues that we discuss. I'm sure many of you heard many things about Islam. Today, hopefully, I'll be able to give you some new information about Islam, maybe that you haven't heard before. For example, you should realize that today we're going to be discussing Islam, which is the only monotheistic religion in the world today. I read books that are basically texts for religious courses, and they talk about the development of religions, how in the primitive times the people were feared most everything, they feared everything in nature, and they selected these things as God. And then as time went on, they became more advanced, less primitive, and they began to develop more modern theology, and finally they said the highest state is monotheism. First of all, Islam doesn't agree with this history of mankind, but it is in fact, though talking about Islam, and it talks about the highest pinnacle of religion being that of monotheism. And probably you haven't heard it before, but in fact Islam is the only monotheistic religion in the world. If you look at the Old Testament, if you look at Judaism and Christianity, the New Testament, both of these two would claim to be monotheistic religion. You see, for example, in Judaism, we don't find, in fact, monotheism. Because monotheism is the belief in only one God. There's only one creator, there's only one sustainer. Only one. He's indivisible. He has certain natures, but there's only one. The religion of Judaism, which is one of the three that they claim to be monotheistic, does not believe this. You read the Old Testament and see that the religion of Judaism believes that the God of Israel is one. But Judaism never denied that other gods exist. They claim that the God of Israel is one, and the people of Israel have to worship that one God. I really find cases in the Old Testament when Jews left the Promised Land and they developed the worship of other people because they figured that the God of Israel is only for Israel. When they leave Israel, they no longer have to worship that God. So we find in the Old Testament, that is in fact, you don't find monotheism, that there's only one God and the denial of any other God. But Judaism only says that Israel has, or the tribe of Israel has only one God, and they must worship that one God. They don't deny the existence of other gods, although they claim that their own God is superior. Also in Christianity, well, the problem we have in discussing exactly the nature of God in Christianity is basically the Christians themselves have had a long debate on it themselves. But what we found in general, we come up with the principle of Trinity, and that God is one, but has three separate entities involved, and that's one. But here again we have, again, a deviation from monotheism. We have the same problem as we had before the advent of Islam, during the time of idolatry. So suppose, for example, in the case of Christianity, if the Father wills something and the Son wills something else, then again you see we have the same problem as in idolatry, and again we don't have monotheism in a strict sense. And also in the case of Christianity, you'll notice that the three parts of the one God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, even have a certain order. You never go into a Christian church or hear any Christian say, for example, in the name of the Holy Ghost, the Son, and the Father. This is a blasphemy, in fact. This means that there's some sort of order to these three, that it isn't, in fact, a monotheism. So, the Muslim people in the world are the only truly monotheistic people or religion in the world. Another area about Islam that some people are confused about is who exactly are the Muslims. Much propaganda is given that the Muslims are basically Arabs and the Arabs are Muslims. Many times I've read in newspapers and even in religious texts, when referring to Muslims, they refer to them as Arabs. They even talk about the Arab Empire, or the Muslim, instead of saying the Muslim Empire, they talk about the Arab Empire. Well, this, of course, is false. Myself, I'm an example to prove it. I come from Spain. I'm not Arab, but I am Muslim. And in fact, Islam is the religion of almost 1 billion people in the world, and as you know, the Muslims, the Arabs, are much less than 1 billion. In fact, the religion with the largest population of Muslims is Indonesia. There's 90 million Muslims, and of course, it's a non-Arab country. Other countries with many millions of Muslims include China, Afghanistan, Russia, Malaysia, Nigeria, India, all these, of course, being non-Arab countries. In fact, the number of Muslims in China is so great that it's the only religious group to attain minority status in Red China or in mainland China. Furthermore, there's large minority groups of Muslims in other countries throughout the world, including Yugoslavia, South Africa, the Philippines, and even Argentina. There's a large number of Muslims. And at one time, for example, the population of Bulgaria was more than 50% Muslim before the fall of the Ottoman Empire. And still to this day in the country of Albania, the population of Muslims is over 90% in Albania. Well, this is who the Muslims are, but of course we have to see what is Islam exactly. Islam, as I said, is the only monotheistic religion, and the word by itself means, has two meanings, or the root has two meanings. One is peace and the other is submission. So the word Islam, when it comes in that form, means the peace that comes about from our willful submission to the will of Allah. And Allah in Islam, or in Arabic, is basically the simply the meaning or the name for the supreme deity. And again, part of its pure monotheism, we find that the word Allah has no masculine or feminine form. It has no plural form whatsoever, such as God or Goddess or Goddess or God. And this again is part of the pure monotheism of Islam. The name Allah is strictly applied just to Allah, the one supreme being, and doesn't apply to any of the other false gods that we find in history. And also this aspect that Islam has the name for Allah is also very important when we discuss, as we discussed before on the Davis campus, about the prophecies about Muhammad in the Bible. Because in the book of David, in the Psalms, there's a very clear prophecy about the one who will come with the name of God to the people. As I mentioned earlier, Islam doesn't believe that religion developed from simple idolatry and fear of nature, etc. But according to Islam, this religion is the first and final religion that was sent down from Allah, of God, to mankind. And it started with the first man or first creation on this earth. Since that time, Allah has sent different prophets to teach the people about himself, to teach the people how to behave as humans as they were created. So Allah sent Abraham, sent Noah, sent Moses, sent Jesus. All of these people were prophets sent by Allah to bring the people back to the worship of the only one God. To read through the Old Testament, although again it's changed with talking about just the one God of Israel, we see that the mission of all these prophets was to bring the people back to the one God. Finally, this line of prophets came to an end with the Prophet Muhammad, who arose in Mecca some 1400 years ago. He was the last messenger, the last prophet that Allah sent to this mankind. Now there's basically three reasons why he is the last prophet, three or four. Number one, he's the only one who claims to be the last prophet. Again, if we read through the books, the Old Testament, the New Testament, if we read through also the Hindu and the Buddhist scriptures, we see no one claiming to be the last prophet or the last messenger sent by God. Furthermore, and again, this is a topic for another prophecy, is that he is the prophet that all the other prophets pointed to that would be coming. For example, we find clearly in the book of Genesis that Moses is describing a prophet who will come, who is like Moses, who will be sent from the brethren of Israel, or the children of Ishmael, who will come. So Moses pointed to him. Also we find in New Testament indications that this prophet will be coming. Also we find in Buddhist scripture indication that this that a new prophet will be coming. And all of these prophecies about a further or new prophet are all of them, if you look at them closely, are all fulfilled in the last prophet, the prophet Muhammad, for who is in fact the promised prophet. Furthermore, we see that the religion or the law that the Prophet Muhammad brought was the only law of all the messengers we know that was sent for all of mankind. It was sent for all of the creation. Again, if we look at the other texts, I'm assuming that the people here are more familiar with the Bible, so I'm referring mostly to the Bible, but it's true for Buddhist or Hindu texts and other religions. If we look to the Bible, we see a stress, a great stress on the fact that these prophets and this religion was sent for the tribe of Israel. Jesus himself said that he came to gather the lost tribe of Israel, to bring them back to religion. And so their religion actually, or the law that they brought, was sent for a very small portion of mankind. Each one of these prophets had a specific mission, a specific group of people. But the Prophet Muhammad never mentioned anything like that. In fact, he mentioned the opposite, that he was sent for all of mankind, Arab and non-Arab, black and white. And the last point of why there's no need for any prophet after the Prophet Muhammad is that, in fact, in this religion, or in Islam, we find the perfected religion that can be applied from the time of the Prophet Muhammad to the day of resurrection. All the statutes that are needed to be implemented can be found in the religion of Islam. Those things that don't change in humankind, Allah has applied the laws to them, and those things that do change in humankind, Allah has left them free to change in the religion of Islam. So in fact, this last religion was in fact the perfect religion, and there's no need for any change or any modification whatsoever. Also, as you're familiar, and as I've been referring to, Allah, when he sent these messengers, many of them he sent with a book or with a scripture. He sent, for example, Moses with the Torah, he sent David with the Psalms, Jesus with the Gospel, etc. And also the Prophet Muhammad also was sent with the scripture. And this scripture is known as the Quran, which literally means the reading. It was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad bit by bit over a period of 23 years. So this tells us actually what Islam is. It's a complete code of life which is based upon the revelation and the guidance from Allah. And it is agreed upon by all scholars, whether they be Muslim or non-Muslim, that this guidance that we find in the Quran, or the Quran that we have now, is exactly the same as the Quran that was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad. This is agreed upon by all scholars, both Muslim and non-Muslim. There's a book by John Burton about it called The Collection of the Quran, where he states, contrary to the traditional view, he states that in fact the whole Quran was collected during the time of the Prophet Muhammad, and it existed at that time. And in fact there's a Quran that exists from 27 years after the Prophet Muhammad, and it exists in the library in Russia. And anybody can take this copy of the Quran and take it with any copy of the Quran, and we'll find that there's no change whatsoever. The Quran itself is not like the Bible or any other scripture. It doesn't contain stories of the Prophet Muhammad, but in fact the Quran is the direct, exact revelations from God to the Prophet Muhammad that were collected. So it's not stories or collections about the Prophet that were written after his time, but it's the exact revelation that God gave to the Prophet Muhammad through the angel Gabriel. When we read the Quran, we'll find that all of these verses are connected by the central theme of the Quran, and that is showing mankind how to act in accordance with the will of Allah. The Quran, in fact, is a great miracle, as witnessed by many people, again, whether they be Muslim or not Muslim. And in fact, it was the only miracle that was claimed by the Prophet Muhammad. If you look at the history of the prophets, God sent different prophets at different times
and sent each one with something special. For example, during the time of Jesus, Allah sent Jesus with a special sign to a certain people, because at that time those people were especially gifted in the art of medicine. And if we look at what Allah sent Jesus with, we find that Jesus was able to heal the blind. He was able to bring back the dead, in one case, and other similar things. He was able to heal the sick. And to those people who were so skilled in medicine, this must have been a great miracle, because for them they couldn't have done it. But he showed all the time that this miracle comes just from Allah, the only one who could do it. Also in the case of Moses, we find Moses at the time of the Torah, that the people of that time were masters of magic and sorcery. And so Allah sent the prophet Moses with something related to magic and sorcery, and that was, of course, his staff and his hand, which were two miracles that they showed to people. Also, the same is the case with the Prophet Muhammad. At the time of the Prophet Muhammad, the Arabs were excellent in speech, in dialectics, in eloquence, and in poetry. And therefore, when Allah sent the Prophet Muhammad, he challenged them with something that they themselves were excellent in, and that was a literary masterpiece, the Quran. Allah in the Quran challenges the unbelievers to bring this one short chapter similar to what we find in the Quran. And at that time, the unbelievers mustered all their power to do it, and they couldn't come up with verses or chapters similar to what we find in the Quran. And that challenge, also since that time, has never been met. In fact, there's many miraculous parts of the Quran which I'm sure the Arabs at that time did not realize how miraculous they are. For example, one verse of the Quran, Allah is talking about the resurrection and warning us about that day. And He says in the Quran that, yes, verily Allah is able to restore their very fingertips. Now, of course, Allah is just pointing to the magnificence of His creation and the resurrection day. And I'm sure at that time the Arabs didn't realize, and this was proclaimed 1400 years ago, that this is really a great miracle and a great sign by Allah. Now we know that everybody has a distinct fingertip, that everyone in creation has something different, not the same fingerprint. And yet in this verse, Allah is telling us exactly how detailed Allah knows us and how He'll be able to bring us back, that even down to our very fingertips, Allah will restore us back to our life. And He pointed to something which now we can see is a great sign for us, although I'm sure at that time they didn't realize the nature of that sign. In fact, the Quran is filled with such verses that can only point to the truth of the Quran being, in fact, a revelation from Allah and not being written by any human. For those who are interested in verses like this, there's a book called The Bible, the Quran, and Science, written by a French scholar, a non-Muslim, by the name of Maurice Bouquet. And in this book, although he's a non-Muslim, he concluded that the Quran is such a magnificent and miraculous work that it could not have been the work of any mortal at the time of Muhammad. And of course, this isn't shocking for Muslims, as they know for 1400 years that in fact a revelation from Allah. Although in some ways the Quran is similar to a book that Allah revealed, but when Allah revealed this book, He just didn't send it down on a mountain so people can go and read it and act by it. But Allah sent this Quran through the Prophet Muhammad. And the Prophet Muhammad gave us a living example of how it is that we should behave according to this Quran. In the Quran itself, there's a verse that says that the Prophet is an excellent example for you, for those who wish to return to Allah. And this practical example is something that is missing from most other religions. Because in fact, although the Prophet Muhammad lived 1400 years ago, we have details of every aspect of his life. How he drank, how he walked, how he did everything. And this in fact saves the Muslim mind, or the Muslim, from really the mind from wandering as to how to behave. I talk with people from other religions, and they tell me sometimes they do their best to apply their religion, but sometimes they get confused. How should they behave in a certain situation? The religion really doesn't offer that guidance, because the example that they have isn't complete, or they don't have enough information about that example. But we find in Islam, we don't have this problem. This problem, I was reading an article, leads to many psychological problems, that you want to follow religion, but you don't know exactly how to act. But in Islam, we don't have that problem, because we know exactly how the Prophet led his life. We have detailed examples, detailed aspects of his life. And so therefore, any situation arises, we don't have to worry, we don't have to wonder about it, but we know exactly how the Prophet Muhammad behaved. And if we come across something didn't happen at his time, then we have an example similar to what he did in his life. One thing that's forgotten about the religion of Islam, and is separated from some of the other religions, is that if we follow the Quran, if we follow the Prophet Muhammad, then this actually benefits us both in this life, living in this life, and also in the hereafter. It will also benefit us as individuals and also as a society. For example, just to give just simple examples, it was the practice of the Prophet Muhammad to use what is known as a two-stick, miswak, which is basically a branch of a tree, and he exhorted his followers also to use it. And he would take it and use it similar to how we use a toothbrush today. And he told his followers that they should also do the same. Of course, many people now say, well, it doesn't matter because we have scientists now who have figured out that to preserve teeth, all of this, have to clean the teeth and use toothpaste and this sort of thing. But actually, even in this simple example, the Prophet's guidance is better, because the miswak, the original miswak from a certain type of tree, has 7 types of fluoride, which is greater than any of the modern toothpaste. Furthermore, even in the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad, we even see how he cleaned his teeth with his miswak, or with his toothpaste. That he would clean from the gums to the end of the tooth. And now, of course, modern scientists have figured out, oh, this is the correct way to brush your teeth. And also, when modern scientists figured this out, they all congratulated each other, oh, look what we came up with, toothbrush, toothpaste, and now we can save everybody's teeth. We see actually the Prophet, even in this case, in all other cases, still has given us the excellent example to follow. Both in this life, as I said, this will benefit us in this life and also in the hereafter. And there's one more aspect. This simple example I gave has to do with physical things, physical well-being. But this thing, scientists can talk about somehow. They have some knowledge about it. But also, the Prophet didn't just tell us how to behave in physical manner, but also in moral aspects, the Prophet taught us how to behave. And the moral aspect is something that the philosophers, the scientists, the psychologists still haven't figured out how to live your life in such a way that you'll be happy both spiritually and physically. And of course, the second benefit that I referred to is the benefit in the next life, in the hereafter. According to Islamic belief, there will be a day of resurrection where Allah will bless and reward those who were sincere to Him and followed His teaching in this life. Some people are of the opinion that as long as we believe in God and try to act in a sincere way, this should be all that is required of us. We believe in God and we try to be nice to everybody. But there's a fallacy in this reasoning. And again, this fallacy is due to the fact that Islam doesn't just benefit us as individuals, but also as a society as a whole. Islam is laying down a certain social structure, which all of Islam should follow. And this structure, individual and social structure, came from the one who created us, the one who has all knowledge of the universe, and the only one who has the knowledge who can guide us. For example, if we say, oh, we believe in God and we'll try to do the best we can, we can just take one simple example, which I'm a little bit familiar with because I'm studying economics. Just take the example of interest, paying or receiving interest. In the religion of Islam, interest, paying and receiving is forbidden, not allowed. Now someone may say, well, Okay, someone is borrowing money from me, and I'll be nice to him, I'll pay him interest, etc. Just as being a nice person, I want to help him, I want to be kind to him. But actually, if interest develops in a person, if the drive for interest develops in a person or in a community or in an economic system, then, as we've seen in economic studies, we'll find many evils resulting from just that thing of interest and developing of the system of interest. Now, as an individual who says, I'm sincere to God and I just did it as a favor to him, hey, this may be okay from your side, but what have you done to society as a whole? What have you done actually to the moral character of that person? Okay, these sort of things, the one who says, I'm just acting sincere to God, can't answer these questions. But the one who is following the religion sincerely and in every aspect can answer these questions. Because we know that this is forbidden, for example, the paying of interest, receiving interest, and there's a reason for that. Because God, in His wisdom, has told us that for the best society, for the best action, then you should behave in that way. Now, about the Prophet Muhammad, I haven't said much yet, and of course, to talk about Islam without talking anything about his life would be complete. Basically, he was born in the town of Mecca some 1,300 years ago. At the age of 40, he received his first revelation from God. Before that time, he lived among his people as a trader. That's of course not with a T, that's with a D, okay? He lived among his people, and for 40 years, they saw his character. And they even developed a nickname for him, and that was Al-Amin, meaning the trustworthy. So during those 40 years, the character of the Prophet Muhammad impressed the people of Mecca so much that they had this nickname for him. But we see that as soon as the Prophet Muhammad received his revelation, as soon as we see the Prophet Muhammad calling the people to the one God, immediately they begin to reject him, although they give no reason for it. For example, one time he called his people and he asked them, if I were to tell you that there's an army approaching over the mountain, would you believe me? And they told him, yes, because we have no lie from you before. So he said, then I warn you of something much greater, and that is the punishment of Allah. So immediately they turned away and refused to listen to him. Although they gave no reason for why they couldn't listen to him. In fact, they even went further than that. This one who they called the trustworthy, they began to persecute him. And they persecuted him so much and his small band of followers that they had to migrate from their hometown of Mecca, give up all their possessions, and migrate to Medina. But the truth of Islam was so powerful that within 10 years, the Prophet was able to return from Medina to Mecca at the head of an army of 10,000, and they conquered Mecca in a bloodless battle. And at that time, the Prophet gave a general amnesty to all the people of Mecca who had fought him for the past 10 years and driven him out of the city. And this prophecy was so great. I mean, this event was so great. Of 10,000 people, 10,000 religious people entering into a city that had driven them out and conquering that city in a bloodless battle and then giving general amnesty. It seems like it's an amazing event that could only happen once in a creation. And in fact, it was such an amazing event. And if we look to the book, if we look to the earlier books, if we look to the book of Jude, if we look to the book of Genesis, if we look at the writings from Enoch, if we look at the Hindu scriptures, if we look at the Buddhist scriptures, all of them describe an event that's going to occur where a man comes with 10,000 of his followers, with the law from Allah or from God, and will conquer a certain city and rule that city in peace, and rule that city according to the will of God. This event has been described in detail, and as I said again, can be the topic of another talk. It's been described in detail in all of these books, and the details clearly point to this event that occurred in Mecca some 1400 years ago. The main thing about Islam in this life is that the character of the Muslim is affected by the religion of Islam. Islam seeks to change mankind, to bring mankind back to the way of Allah, to bring him back to his natural way. And to do this, Islam being a practical religion, doesn't just exhort people, oh, be good, be aware of God, act according to his way. No. Islam sets up certain practices that train the man to do that. As certain practices that train the man to be aware of Allah at all times, and to worship Allah, and to behave according to the rules of Allah. And these practices are known as the five pillars of Islam. The second one is prayer five times a day. And in this, the Muslims stop whatever they may be doing at appointed times during the day, five times during the day, to worship Allah, to remember Allah, and to bring Allah back in their heart. And you can just imagine what sort of effect this is going to have on a person, that five times a day he stops what he's doing, to return to Allah, to pray to Allah, to ask Allah for his forgiveness. You can just imagine someone who just left the mosque, where the prayer is usually held, just left the mosque, praying to Allah, and he goes to commit a sin. Well, it's not actually that easy to do when you just left Allah in prayer, and you know in a little while, later in the day, you're going to have to return to Allah. So this prayer five times a day develops in mankind the discipline to worship Allah and the discipline to follow all of Allah's laws. One of the other pillars is the payment of a tribute. And this again stresses the fact that Islam believes in religion as a whole that encompasses all of our lives. The payment of the tribute is a payment that goes from the wealthy individuals to the poor individuals in the society. It is a form of purifying one's wealth. And again, it's meant and it's paid to please Allah. Furthermore, we have the fasting of the lunar month of Ramadan. And this month, the Muslims fast from before dawn until sunset for the whole month. After sunset, they're allowed to eat and drink. But during from dawn until sunset, from before dawn until sunset, they're not allowed to eat or drink. And of course, all religions have fasting and charity and also prayer in them. You won't find any religion on earth that doesn't include these aspects, although in some cases they're not applied to religion. The benefits of fasting, of course, are well known. They develop the awareness of Allah. They develop the feelings for the poor fellows of the community, etc. Another one of the pillars of Islam is the Hajj, or the pilgrimage to Mecca. And in this pillar, Muslims gather from all over the world at a specific time to enter Mecca and to perform certain rites and rituals. Now this pillar, actually, you can imagine that thousands of Muslims all turning towards one God, all turning towards the same religion, gather at one specific time in the year in Mecca to worship Allah, all of them dressed in similar clothing. You can just imagine the effect on the mind and the attitude of the Muslim as he leaves that gathering, where he is gathered with thousands of his brothers and sisters just to worship Allah. The purpose of the religion of Islam is to bring back the Muslim to the one God. And this is the first pillar of Islam on which all of the other pillars rest on, and that is to testifying that there is no God except God and that Muhammad is the messenger of God. To look at ourselves in this physical world, we see that in one way, in one certain way, we all worship Allah, or we all bow down to Allah's will. And that's in the physical sense. If we go so many days without eating, we'll starve to death. This is a law from God. It's not the law of nature, but it's the law that God designed. In the physical sense, all of us bow down to Allah's will. We can't jump so high because of Allah's love gravity. We can't go without eating, we can't go without drinking. All of these laws are from Allah. And so in the physical sense, all of us are bowing down to Allah's will. But what Islam stresses is that we shouldn't just bow down to Allah's will in the physical sense, but also in the moral sense, or in the moral realms of our life. And those areas where we have a choice between doing one action or another action, between, for example, doing something good or something bad. These are those areas where Islam asks us to bow down to Allah's will and follow His guidance. In the world today we find actually a situation which is similar to the time of the Prophet Muhammad. At that time the world was steeped in a gross spiritual darkness, where lives were given up purely for material gain. And we see here again that the world now has found itself in a similar situation, where the spiritual realm of life has been forgotten, that the honor of life, blood, and property mean nothing, and the face of nationalism, capitalism, socialism, whatever. The Prophet himself said about himself that he is like a man standing in front of the fire, pulling us back, trying to keep us from jumping into the fire and destroying ourselves. But really again we see that mankind is again standing in front of sort of a fire. And this fire is the great destruction that is being carried out by man upon man. If we look to see what Allah brought in the Quran and what the message of the Prophet Muhammad is, we find that in fact the solution to these problems exists in his teaching. The greatest revolution the Prophet brought about was the return to the faith in one God, the pure monotheism, without any adulteration, without any pagan influences whatsoever. And when this teaching really is implemented, then this changes the whole outlook and moral behavior of man. He realizes that all of mankind has been created by the same God. He realizes that all of mankind should worship and should behave as God. In fact, the influence of Islam in this realm was so great that when the Muslims conquered part of India, the Hindu philosophers or theologists changed many of their teachings to correspond closer to monotheistic teachings, because they found many of their followers leaving their religion and going to Islam. The second thing which the Prophet Muhammad brought about, and which is also missing in the world today, is the concept of human dignity. In the religion of Islam, mankind is looked at as the creation, as the noble creation of the one creator who created all beings. The noble creation. The one that he created all of this creation for. In Islam, there's no pessimism of worthlessness. And there's no, also in Islam, we don't have the feeling that mankind by its own nature is sinful. This idea is not found in Islam. Mankind is in fact a noble creature, and he should behave as a noble creature. He is different from the animals, and he should behave differently from the animals by using his intellect and by obeying God. Also we see that the Prophet, as I alluded to earlier, came with us with the equality and the brotherhood of all mankind. In Islam, there's no honor due to anyone through the skin color or nationalism. But the only honor given to anyone is how faithful that person is to God. There's no nationalism in Islam, and there's no tribalism in Islam. Also, the Prophet brought with him the unity of spirit and matter. In Islam, we no longer have this division between the spiritual realm of life and the actual physical realm of life. In Islam, for example, political affairs, business affairs, actions with our lives, everything is based upon Allah. There's no division in our life. This dichotomy between the physical and the spiritual way of life is a false dichotomy, and Islam came to end it. In Islam, there's no such thing as render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and render unto God what is God's. And lastly, the Prophet made us conscious of our ultimate end. He made us realize that at our end, we all return to the one Creator who created all of us. We all return to Him, The one who gave us the guidance in this life, the one who showed us the way, the one who showed us the correct way of life, we'll all return to him in the end. Thus we see that the teachings of Islam provide a clean sweep of the current problems in today's civilization. And in fact, it wasn't an overstatement when Arnold Toynbee, and also when George Bernard Shaw said that the only hope for humanity lies in a return to Islam. Or when Napoleon Bonaparte said, "I hope the time is not far when I shall be able to unite all the wise and educated men of all the countries and establish a uniform regime based upon the principles of the Quran, which alone are true and which alone can lead men to happiness." And with that, folks, I'd like to open the floor for any questions or comments that anyone may have.
I presume that the majority, or at least 50% of Muslims, believe that the Quran is the end word. You know, that's it. You know, what you live your life then is what it says in the Quran. You did mention a little bit, you didn't specify it as a hadith. Is the way that Muhammad lived, and that the Muslims go by some of the writings of the Hadith and also living their lives. Because the Hadith was not either written by God Allah or was not written by Muhammad, could it not possibly be that the Hadith is a false testimony of Muhammad's way? The way he lived, because it's written by other people and it was written a considerable amount of years later, since his death.
Okay. Basically, as you said, the Muslims follow the Quran and they follow the actions of the Prophet Muhammad. Because as I said, the Prophet Muhammad is a perfect example for us to follow. This is a verse in the Quran. And also the Quran says us to obey Allah and also obey the Prophet. So it's obligatory on the Muslims to obey the Prophet. In many verses, Allah says that He has sent Allah with the book and the wisdom, or with the reminder, and this is the practice of the Prophet Muhammad. So actually, it's based upon the Quran that we follow the Prophet Muhammad. This is directly from the Quran. Now what the Prophet Muhammad said and did, as he said, these are collected in Hadith. The Hadith is the body of literature which contains the sayings of Muhammad, the actions of Muhammad, etc. This Hadith began to be written down during the lifetime of Prophet Muhammad. We know that for sure, that during his time people collected Hadith and wrote Hadith. Immediately after his death people continued to collect Hadith. So since in fact the time of the Prophet Muhammad, we know that the Hadith had been collected and had been written down. Now, as you said yourself, there's possibility for false hadith to come about, since all of it wasn't collected at the Prophet's time. Well, this is no problem because the Muslim scholars themselves obviously were the first to recognize this fact. When false hadith began to appear, they were the first to point out that false hadith exists, and they were the first to point out how to tell whether a hadith is true or not. And the science of Hadith. So if anybody claims what you claim, he has to bring his proof from the Quran and Hadith. And we don't find any proof for these said statements in the Quran and Hadith. So there's no problem for that. The scholars himself have said this point. And there's no divine person. Even the Prophet Muhammad himself wasn't divine. He just received revelation. No one considers him divine. Okay, so there's no problem with anybody coming after the Prophet Muhammad who is divine and making that. No, because if you go to some people try to prove it, but again, it can be shown from the Quran and Hadith that it doesn't exist.
You're talking about the Mahdi.
Okay, he's talking about the Mahdi, Imamiya, specific type of Mahdi. Okay, even the Mahdi, the one, all the Mahdi is that we believe that before the resurrection day, Islam will be strong again. And there will be a leader who will bring Islam back. And that is known as the Mahdi, that person.
known as the Mahdi. He is not divine, he has no special character, say other than any other kingdom, but he is the Mahdi, the one who brings his son back. That's all there is to that.
Yeah, the lady person pointed to me, there seems to be a lot of similarities between Islam and Christianity and the Quran, the Bible. And, like, what are some of the significant differences between the two books? And why was the Bible even written? If you have the Quran, it seems like, I mean, they do seem to be pretty similar.
Why was the Bible written? Because we have the Quran?
Yeah.
Well, okay, obviously the Quran came after this.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, but I will try to...
Okay.
First of all, there should be a lot of similarity, because according to our belief, Jesus and Muhammad were both sent by the same God. Okay. So there should be some similarity. As the Prophet one time said, that all the Prophets are brothers, meaning they bring a similar teaching. And as I said, all of them taught go back to Allah, to worship Allah. Okay? Now, difference between Bible and Quran, the actual Bible we have now is not the exact sayings of Jesus. This is accepted by many Christian scholars, for some officially fundamentalists doesn't know it, obviously.
Okay, now how does that come to be? Why?
What do you mean, why exactly?
Why does it change?
Okay, the teachings that were sent to Jesus, or as I said, meant for a specific time and a specific people. They weren't meant to be applied from then until the day of resurrection. But in the case of the Quran, as I said, it's different. The Quran was sent specifically for all of mankind from the time of Muhammad to the day of resurrection. Yes. Okay, so the Quran has to be preserved. And Allah in the Quran itself said, we read and we preserve it. Okay. Because it has that purpose, but the Bible never had that purpose, or the what was revealed to Isa, Jesus. Okay, it never had that purpose to say until the day of the okay. Any other aspect of that question?
No, I'm trying to think, no, I guess not now. I think so.
Yeah.
Going back to people, interpreting what is the Quran, what does the Quran say, what does the Hadith say, is the traditional assumption that within the Quran has always been 2.5% of a person's income. Because it's not in the Quran, to my knowledge, it's not in the Quran specifically what is the percentage of a person's income to give, should it not be up to each individual's ways of what percentage of their income they should give, instead of making the standard traditional, come down through the years, that it should be 2.5%.
Okay, the amount isn't in the Quran, but it's in Hadith. Okay, it's very good Hadith. So the first point, we have to follow the Hadith, so we have to follow this 2.5%. Furthermore, you can just, it's not, as I said again, it is also meant for society as a whole, benefit society as a whole. And this aspect, again, will be part of that. That if someone, suppose this year, everybody says, well, we give as much as we want for God's sake, and decides this year nobody gives for God's sake, for example. So this means that the purpose of the zakat will not be fulfilled. So there must be some amount that has to be given. Certainly, the zakat is a worship in the form of your wealth. Okay, or in the form of your material possession. Prayer isn't that type of worship. Okay, zakat is different, or the poor do is different. It's a form of worship and from your wealth. And there's specific rules for prayer, how to pray. There's also specific rules for zakat, or the poor do that you have to follow. Okay, so all these and other points lead to the conclusion that the 2.5%, which comes from the hadith, is what we have to follow. And it was mentioned at that level, for specific purpose from Allah. Now, of course, it doesn't mean you give 2.5% and you don't give anything else for the rest of the time. That is what you have to give, obligated upon you, but as we find the Quran many times, it stresses that we should give, be charitable, and we find it right nowadays, probably Muslims probably are the most generous of all people if you travel through Muslims. This character of generosity is still existing. Okay, but the 2.5% is from the hadith, and this is what we must call. Yeah.
Did you say then that all people will go back to Allah at the end?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that means that all people will what is the afterlife?
Oh, okay. Yeah. I have it there, but I think I skipped the page. This talk one time I gave in Davis and it turned out very long, so I didn't want to say anything happened again. As I said, we believe that there will be a day of resurrection. Okay? And everyone in this life is free to choose whether they want to follow God or not. Okay? And on that day, Allah will reward those who follow Him and punish those who didn't follow Him. Okay? Who willingly didn't follow Him. Those will be punished. Those that willingly follow Him for His pleasure, to take His reward, intending to take His pleasure, then there will be rewarded on that day. So on that day all of mankind will come. Those that follow Allah will be rewarded, those that didn't will be punished.
What's the line following Allah? He says what is following Allah and what is not following Allah.
Okay, Allah sent, for example, this Quran as the guidance for us. And He says it clearly, this is the guidance for us. So we can have the sincere intention come, we can, if we read the Quran, all this and hadith, we see this. First principle is to have sincere intention to follow what He is saying, to follow the Quran and the Hadith. Okay, that's the first principle. So there's points like that that Allah gives us in the Quran. Now, for example, on that day, who Allah will come to us and tell us who exactly followed for that purpose. Maybe somebody is following the Quran but he's not following it to seek God's pleasure. Maybe he's trying to deceive people or something, like a hypocrite. Okay, on that day, of course, only Allah knows that he'll make that clear. But as for who is following it, Allah gives us certain instructions that we must follow, and we have to be sincere to Him and follow. Does it make much sense that Allah says, pray 5 times a day, and I say, oh, I'm sincere to Allah, I believe in what He says, but I don't do it. There's something illogical there. So by one's actions, one shows how sincere he is to Allah.
What happens when you make mistakes, though?
Okay. Yeah, sure. if you make mistakes, you make repentance. You ask Allah to forgive you, and you make a sincere repentance. You try not to make that mistake again. Don't make a mistake and say, oh, God, forgive me, and do the same thing again. Or while you're, like, for example, wine is illegal in Islam, you don't take one sip and say, God, forgive me, take the next one and say, God, forgive me.
Okay, so a person never really knows for sure he's going to live a while forever, right?
No.
You only find out when you die, right?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing we can do as humans is do our best to follow Allah. Okay. Like, for example, maybe somebody now is following Allah and he has a change of heart for some reason. Okay, and then he starts, whatever he wants to do, following his own desires. He sets his desires up as really a partner with Allah. He follows his own desires instead of following Allah. Okay. Or, for example, someone like myself, before I wasn't Muslim, I converted to Islam. And so, something like that. Also, if you saw me back then, you say, well, for sure this guy is going to be coming. Now, hopefully, it won't be true. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I am sure you know, Abu Manasir, put a lot of value on kiosks. And I'd like to ask you.
I guess you've been studying Islam before. I don't know why, but.
I want to ask, do you feel that kiosk is, as it relates to the hadith, is another form of watering down what has Muhammad said and what is written in the Quran?
Well, okay, kiosk, I assume everybody knows what kiosk is, so I'm not ready to imply that. Kiosk means ruling by an hour. Okay, and Abu Hanifa was a great Muslim scholar. If you look at what Abu Hanifa did, he would, any question that comes up, first he goes to the Qur'an and looks for the answer in the Qur'an. Okay. If he doesn't find the answer in the Qur'an, he goes to a hadith. If he doesn't find the answer in hadith, he goes to what the Muslims, the early Muslims agreed upon, that this is right. And if he doesn't find it there, then he uses qiyas. He reasons by analogy. Like, for example, there's a hadith that the Prophet did such and such, and now we have a similar situation, then he rules according to the same. So qiyas isn't something that it does away with the Qur'an hadith. No, he only used qiyas if he didn't find the answer in the Qur'an hadith or the collective agreement.
Well, do you feel that this is true, the need to go into interpreting to that point? Do you feel that it is a form of watering down the
No, I don't. Okay, now besides Kriyasam, there is something else known as Mukaha. It said that Islam, the laws of Islam have certain goals. To preserve the religion, to preserve life, to preserve wealth, to preserve the intellect, and to preserve the family relations, the family ties. These are the goals of the laws of Islam. So some people, they didn't use Qiyas directly. Now, if they didn't find something in Quran or Hadith or the agreement, then they would go by maslaha or public utility or welfare. They would decide according to the law of the Sharia, the law of Islam, wants to sanctify life, wants to protect life. It's one of the goals. So if something comes up, they'll say, well, we should do that thing that protects life because this is one of the goals of Islam. Maybe somebody else will use Qiyas in this case. So there's no problem in this case about this applying Islam. In both cases, you're doing your best to find what's the Islamic solution to that problem. And that's what we're asking you. Okay, for example, right now I'm doing research on Islamic economic development in Islamic society. Many things, you really have to do a detailed study of the Quran, Hadith, to find out exactly what to do after the research. I don't think it's any problem. Yes.
According to Islamic law, what would be a just amount of taxation?
4.5%. Okay, and if you want to see my dissertation on the board, I can show you.
In other words, if I live in an Islamic country, the country cannot tax you more than necessary.
Okay, they can tax you more only in cases of dire necessity. Starvation, you know, where they need the money for something, yes, they can take more than that, but otherwise, no. 2.5%. Abu Yusuf, one of the early Islamic scholars, he criticized really the government at that time because they were applying un-Islamic tactics. And he brought the quote from the Quran Hadith that they shouldn't apply it. Yeah.
And what are some of the differences between the branch and the role of men and women?
Okay, basically the differences between the role of the men and women in the Quran. As I said before, the Quran has every law is to apply for society as a whole. Basically in Islam, the position of the man is different from that of the woman. The men basically have to support the wife, has to support the family, and this is not the responsibility of the woman. That's and also in Islam, the role of the man is he must take care of his judicial positions and the governmental positions. Not all of them, some are specifically for women, but in general that's the case. Now in the case of Islam, the woman, for example, owns her own property, is not required, for example, to take care of the house even. According to many scholars, it's the duty of the husband to hire a servant to take care of the house for the woman. That's not her duty. So but basically that's the difference, that the man has certain rights, certain duties of maintenance and societal jobs that the woman doesn't have, she's not responsible for. Now,
Well,
it depends exactly what sort of job. For example, she's allowed to work, but she's not allowed to be the head of the government.
Okay.
No. Okay, but in some cases, she can be a judge for specific matters dealing with women. Okay, she can be a judge. Specific matters in the government dealing with women, she can be a minister, whatever. Okay. Basically, we split the roles between the men and women, and what's a woman's concern, they take care of that. Okay, but as for anything else, for example, the prayers and the fasting, each both has the same responsibility. About learning about Islam, both have the same responsibility. That sort of thing. Yeah?
Yes. Could you talk about Sufism and then where it does relate to the Quran?
Okay, in Sufism you have to...
First of all,
define Sufism for me.
It's
Islamic message. That's how I
okay.
Islamic message.
Okay, cool. That gets me to what I was going to say. We have to differentiate between the Sufism which is based upon the Quran, which is the early Sufism, and the Sufism that is being practiced now. They're not the same, they're quite different. One is based upon the Quran, the other one isn't. For example, the early Sufis never believed anybody could violate any laws of any one of them, I mean, any Sufi, any brother, could violate any laws of the Quran. Okay. So they were mystical or really ascetic in the sense that they applied the laws of the Quran, but they didn't indulge themselves in worldly material things. Okay. That was the early Sufi. That is the Sufi that is based upon the Quran. The present Sufis are engaged in a bunch of innovations that have no relationship whatsoever to Islam. None whatsoever. Most of what they do now has no relationship with Islam. Islam is for us, but throughout the years said that what they're doing is wrong, and they shouldn't be allowed to do those things in the name of Islam. So the early Sufis, basically just more ascetic, applying strictly all the laws of the Quran, but also not concerning themselves too much with worldly goods. The modern day Sufis are into their own really world. You can't, in many cases, you can't even consider them part of Islam.
By knowledge, the Quran doesn't really address itself to any form of mysticism or
ascetic. As I said, the early Sufis, okay, in Islam we're all, I mean, from what you're saying, we're all mystics because they all communicate with God and prayer five times a day and that sort of thing. We all try to get ourselves as close to God as we can. Okay, but that's not the proof of the knowledge.
Yeah. Well, no, I was talking about an early Sufi.
Okay.
It was that their behaviorism was not something that was addressed to the Quran.
Okay, not directly, but the early Sufis basically is they applied every aspect of the Quran and Sunnah, and at the same time they gave up some of the worldly things, not because they thought them bad, but to get closer to God. To lead, for example, a more ascetic life, to feel closer to God. That was the early Sufism, not like what we have now. So that sort of Sufism is more within the realm of Islam. Okay, if I decide I don't want to take a high-paying job because I feel it might affect the way I behave or something like that, this is the type of behavior that the early Sufism has. Yeah.
I heard that there is a great number of Muslims in China and Russia. Could you give me the number of them? How many of them?
Well, it's so hard to keep track of how many are in China. In China, the last estimate that I heard is about 60 million.
Okay.
That's not much by Chinese standards. In the US as well, also there's so many estimates. One thing the Russian government is trying to make it seem like there's not that many. And also during, after World War I, they slaughtered so many that the population fell by thousands. But also it's in the, between, I heard estimates in Russia between 10 and 60 million. That's the rather wide range. But there is quite a few in the Turkish areas of Russia. Yeah.
How about Saudi Arabia? No offense, Saudi Arabia.
I'll ask him to leave.
I know that the women lie in the back of the basket. What do you think? Why should they be in the back? In the back?
Okay, why they're in the back is to be separate from men. For obviously moral purposes, they're kept usually separate from men.
But also there could be a separation by separating the pot.
Yes, right? This is right, yeah.
And give a best seat. Yeah. Instead of all the women back, they have to see.
Yeah.
Does that said in the Quran anywhere? But there was that time they had a box of
salt. Okay, so we'll take camels. Camels is an example.
How is they justified?
Well, how do you justify it? Now, as you said, why they do it that way, who knows?
Okay.
If they can, for example, the women at the time of the Prophet used to have separate camels for them than for the men. Separate buses, this is fine. Okay, now they may not have the money. They may not have the money to buy the buses.
those of you familiar with how much money they have left to go. Because the orange or this is mostly due to custom in their case. They left the book to find in Saudi Arabia, especially with respect to women, is mostly due to custom.
I asked Lennon to the point there for a simple reason, because as soon as you get off the bus, there could be somebody who might ask you, well, then maybe you can intermingle.
Okay, as I said, from Islamic point of view, there's no reason to have it that way. Yeah.
I mean, I think another reason
to intermingle is
that
it's not from Saudi Arabia,
this way, you know, the men don't have to see the women.
Yeah.
It's hard to keep the driver in the front with the horn. And but the men, when they ride, they take them, the driver should take them. And the women in the back, they don't be in.
Oh, the women ride free, so this is...
The second is left in the back. It's optional, they want to pay something, nobody pays them. Besides, you know, in the mosque, women are allowed to go to the mosque and pray, but they have to pay behind them. Because, you know, because they are safety guards, you know, and they were praying. But it's not right for men to see women, because in Islam also, men are required to lower the hands. That's true, you know.
The one has to serve separate book.
Well, this book, you know, it's served, you know. But there with that is, you know. Like, just like here.
So you can have another book serve the same way.
The clarification that you can make is that in having to look in the back, that Islamic ritual or that is, you know,
well, the purpose behind it is consistent with Islam, to separate the men and the women. Because in Islam, the men should look at women, and the women also should look at men.
Should not.
Okay, so the purpose behind it is consistent with Islam. Why exactly it's done that way, okay, you can't prove that it has to be done that way from...
Not one more question.
Yeah.
If man should not be looked at women, why not between men and women?
Well, there's many things that God created for you that you don't do. For example, you can jump off trees, but you don't do it. You can jump off cliffs, but you don't do it. The idea that because it's created, we should indulge in it doesn't make any sense. For example, maybe you don't take heroin. Maybe you think heroin is bad, for some reason you don't take it. Well, God created it, why don't you take it?
And
you don't choose speed, it's up to you. Because maybe you think something's wrong, something is right. Okay, so this looking at the women, for example, if you look at today's society in the United States, I personally don't believe there's any benefit that came about from the moral revolution that we've had in the past 100 years or so. So just because something exists doesn't mean, oh, well, God created, we should do it. Okay, I'm sure yourself you don't do everything that's God created. And probably you won't recommend it for everybody else. So there's no logic behind that argument. Yeah.
Well, the simple answer is that Muhammad addressed that women should be protected from men, from their lustfulness.
And that's good.
But my interpretation is more that he felt more for that the women should be protected from the men, not the men being protected.
Yeah, but it can be applied.
Well, it could be applied both ways. I have a question. You mentioned your stance, but you said you're also converted. I was going to ask historical question is, one, are you a native Spaniard, or are you...
Yeah, I'm native Spaniard. I'm Basque,
actually.
Oh,
what I was going to ask is, I'm curious that you're Muslim, but you said you're a converted Muslim. I was going to say...
If you go to the south of Spain, now since Franco died, the situation is a little bit easier. You find some family, they claim that they've been hiding their Islam since that time. If you go in the houses, you still find Arabic writing. Yeah, how true the same is?
No. To some extent, because the sister thinks we have the more of the Saracen, as we call them, 200 some odd years. People
were
in the
mosque, so they did, but it looked
more like
a minaret.
And it was symbolic,
because it was Sicily. Sicily, yeah. Sicily also
is
a very large
problem. Well, Sicily didn't go through the purge and the Inquisition thing.
don't have to run away. You can just.
To your knowledge, do you know if there, because of loosening of some religious control in Spain, is there a surge of Islamic believers and Muslims in Spain?
Well, there is, but not in what you consider the traditional Muslim areas of Spain. And, for example, Madrid and Barcelona now, they have very large Islamic centers. It has just appeared since Franco died, which was 76, somewhere around there. I remember that's when we all got out of prison. So since that time, there's been a number of two large Islamic centers opened up in Barcelona and Madrid. Now in the south, I'm not sure exactly what the situation is. I'm not from the south, I'm from the most northern part. Anything else? Okay, well, we thank you all for coming, and don't forget there's a mosque in Sacramento, so I'm sure from Boulevard, if anybody would like more information or any literature about Islam, I'm sure there's others who are more than happy to give it to you. Thank you very much. What is it?
Wilson House.
Wilson House, next to the Waterbed Outlet. That's all I know. Okay, thank you very much.